When Sayonara was 11 years old, she and her parents vacationed in Florida for 3 weeks, where, each morning, she was treated to freshly squeezed orange juice, a marked improvement over the pale yellow glop that her mother spooned out of frozen cardboard cans and reconstituted with lukewarm tap water. The color, flavor, and aroma so impressed her that she grew to love everything orange. The fruit, naturally, but also the New Jersey and California cities.
Orange, orange, East Orange, West Orange, South Orange.
The princely family of the Netherlands.
Orange.
The tree.
Orange Boom.
The Julius.
Orange Julius.
Even the Utan.
Orange Utan.
It did not, however, include the faint orange glow that emanated from behind the kitchen door in her Boise Street duplex.
Orange glow.
Yes. Before she pushed open that door, Sayonara, like most North Americans, thought of ears as generally uncommunicative, non-ambulatory, and aluminous. Imagine then...
Ah, aluminous. I read that as aluminous. And I don't know whether it should have had two L's or it should have had been a sort of shiny piece of metal.
Aluminous.
But that doesn't work, though, because luminous has a Latin root, and A is the Greek, and...
That's why she was confused.
Me, too, was aluminous. Imagine better her surprise
and ours when she discovered a nabob of them. Yes, an even hundred sitting at, on, and amongst her kitchen table, quietly cackling, wiggling aerobically, and occasionally levitating. The orange glow appeared to be an incandescence resulting from several dozen of them rubbing one another's lobes in a rather salacious manner. Too stunned to formulate a reaction plan, she just stood there, gaping at the scene, unaware that a nabob and noses, working together, could readily induce tacit hypnotic recommendation on certain sentience, like Sayonara.
I can just imagine her gaping. I mean, is one orifice allowed to gape at another?
I don't know if there's an orificial code of ethics.
It sounds like there should be.
I'll think about that
for next week.
Gradually,
that would be an orificial code.
Orificial code, yes. Gradually, the part of her mind we have.
I'm dropping the scene.
All right. Yes, gradually.
Please,
I'm trying to maintain some decorum here for a change. Gradually, the part of her mind that was open to counsel decided that she should return at once to her arts counsel office, take the $75,000 check. That's not made out to us.
Yeah, certainly not.
From the National Bunyan League's Arts Endowment that was to fund the Muppet Stu Beckett summer theater production, and sign it over to cash. Drive to the all-night bank in Pitskimmie, cash it, and then on the way back, mind you, by now it's half past 3 a.m,
yes.
Stop at the Drug Agora for a 2-gallon bottle of nozzle wash. This all seemed perfectly reasonable to Sayonara, and she was keen to oblige. But as she walked toward the Hudson Wingback, a giant dark cloud descended over her, effecting a kind of elongated figure eight. Before she could say, well, anything, she was sucked up into the same Algonquin hole that had revised the histories of, among thousands of others, Chuck and Clementania Habsburg. Drug Agora, by the way, was a colossal retail pharmaceutical shop that had intimate ties to Eli Lilly. The founder was a man who ran the experimental cosmetic surgery research division, which had concocted, in addition to nozzle wash, Bruce's retinal douches and Tangier ear dewaxer.
And drug agoraphobic cleanser, I'm sure.
If it's on the shelf, he did it. The man's name was Wingate.
Wingate!
Not Bunghollow.
No.
Or Canadian.
No.
But Spengler. Remember?
Yes, I remember.
The guy with the head that looked like a...
Yes, Montana Monadnock.
But more on that later. Boy, don't you just hate segues like that?
More on that later. I'm right like here. I'm with you. I'm with it. You know, I'm right there for you with this story. And then you say, more on that later. It was at 11.
This time, Sayonara didn't have to deliberately recontextualize her body to the consistency of gruel. The Algonquin hold did it for her. Then it reconfigured her concept of reality as a universal constant, reformatted her hypotheses on 12th century Mayan reliquaries, briefly played a game of hide-and-seek with her memory buffers, then shunted her off into a neighboring space continuum while happily not messing with the time department. Meanwhile, and how many times have we heard that transitional ploy used before?
257.
Yes, that's probably true.
You missed essays for the first three shows.
Ah, yes, every other time, meanwhile. Meanwhile, Peter continued to gaze uneasily out the second-story window of his Uncle Kinkajou's Saskatoonian cabin at the plethora of ambulatory head organs headed his way. The eyes...
those eyes.
Red and inflamed from a combination of congested vessels and overall vexation, were especially unsettling in their bloodshot gazes. Naturally, Peter thought they were all staring at him, but in truth, they were focused on the stairway behind him, whence a nervous, fluttery sound suddenly issued. Peter looked around to see a clump of eyeballs, must have been at least an eyrie and a half of them, segregating out of and rising from the pile of noses and ears. They made that annoying sound as they nictitated. Then, en masse, they began to leisurely flutter toward Peter. Tacit hypnotic recommendation appeared to be at work here, too, as the vacation-challenged lad watched the approaching cluster of throbbing globules with indifference. A more perceptive individual might have noticed that the rhythmic pulse was identical to the theme song from 77 Sunset Strip.
Just like this.
Just so. But a more perceptive individual would also likely have tried to jump out of the window at that moment. Fortunately for Peter, the Algonquin hold chose that moment to open a rift in itself and supplant the 90-some eyeballs with an equally surprised, spat-out solitary
sayonara.
That's
get the syllables right here.
Solitary sayonara.
Aura. Dora.
Surprise likewise plays a big part in this 261st episode of Calvus yes. and Damien's
yes.
New Music Bazaar.
Yes.
For example, whatever theme has been chosen for the show will certainly be a surprise to me.
And me!
And nowhere is this more evident than on the surface of the front of the head, from the top of the forehead to the base of the chin of Calvus.
That's me, confused, bewildered, and having no idea what today's theme might be.
No.
Though, I was thinking about the Muppets that you mentioned earlier.
Stu Beckett.
Yes, Muppet the Muppets Stu Beckett. I thought it was very good. You know, I don't know if you got the URL I sent you about the Catchy Tune Central.
I haven't looked at it yet, but
yes,
I do
well, they
it.
Do mention the Muppets, because the Muppets apparently Ennio Morricone did a theme song for some movie which was so Muppet-like that 10 years later the Muppets covered the song. So you might want to look at that site and just see how close the Muppets Stu Beckett come to what you already
probably
said.
Probably earned a sizable foundation from that.
Yes. Speaking of Muppets, Alvin Lucier is what we're listening to here.
Very Muppet-like in his compositional structure.
The Muppet of the long music world.
Yeah.
If you sort of shrink this all down to 30 seconds, you sort of get a rhythm and a beat. But while we have no opportunity to do that, then we have 2 minutes and 30 seconds left to listen to. And his music for gamelan instruments, microphones, amplifiers, and loudspeakers with the Wesleyan University Gamelan Ensemble.
A real toe tapper.
Don't touch that dial, even if you don't have a dial anymore. We'll wake you right up in a second. That was Alvin Lussier. Lussier is really kind of known for this sort of thing. There was a time I recall that he did sort of energetic stuff, but I haven't heard anything energetic for a long time from Lussier. It's very subtle, very delicate, very...
Hummable.
Hummable, yes, if you can maintain one note. So this is from a compact disc called Theme, Alvin Lussier Theme, and this is a recent CD on Lovely Music. Lovely indeed.
Indeed.
Shall we change the tone?
Is it possible, is there anything that would contrast that? What do you have in mind?
I have something not from Lovely Music, but rather from Pogus.
Oh, Ugly Music.
Ugly Music, yes, they do it good. Here's from Vertebra by Matthew Ostrowski. This is the second section, simply called Two.
Good name, catchy name.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Phil Klein. You're listening to Calvos and Damian's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
Here on WGDR Plainfield, let's articulate that better, WGDR Plainfield, Vermont. And on the internet, in real audio, and Shoutcast, once again. That was
another Calvo mix.
Yeah, well, I couldn't resist. I started out with this Matthew Ostrowski piece, Vertebra, Part 2, and then just got the mix itch.
Mm-hmm.
So we heard in that mix, following the beginning of Part 2 of Vertebra, we heard Stephen J. Smith's Crop Circle Music CD. We heard Cut 10, Field Notes. And following that from the Sonic Circuits 5, we heard Beatrice Ferreira's Souffle d'un petit Dieu distrait, the breath of a distraught God.
I see.
Yeah, then we heard from an interesting CD from Asian Improv Records, we heard Yasuhiro Otani and Tatsu Aoki doing Intermingling. Following that, a re-release of early music by Ken Gaburo from 1966-ish, I guess that was. Yeah, we heard Dante's Joint from 1966 for chorus and electronics. And then that mixed right on into Paul Goodman's Plexiglass soundtrack from 1992 from his privately released Six Computer Tapes CD. And then wrapping that section up was the conclusion of music, but oh wait, did I have something else in there? Oh yeah, I did. I had just before that, the conclusion, we had Hideko Kawamoto's Night Ascends from the Ear Like a Butterfly, and then we wrapped it up by the conclusion of section 4 of Matthew Ostrowski's Vertebra to close the rather jumpy circle we created.
Hardly a jumpy circle, and listeners, the Calvo mixes are not only fun and entertaining, but they are educational too. You see how these different components of music do fit together and nest in a nice big stew of musical mix.
Well, that's only because I just gave you an internet printout of Miss Francis from
Ding Dong School.
And you just thought education right away.
Yes, I did.
I'm having fun. You thought education.
I was getting educated. I didn't know before that this tune mixed with that tune. I was pleased to know it. And now, are we headed elsewhere?
Back to New York, to Warren Burt in our interview, and we played 5 for the Coming of Spring last week to wrap up the show. Let's listen to the last of those, and then we'll go back to Warren Burt in New York City. Here's the last of 5 for the Coming of Spring by Warren Burt.
Hi, I'm Warren Burt, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
It's so gentle, so un-red alert-like. Hit it!
Hi, I'm Warren Burt. You're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
Yes! Yes!
I feel much more alive.
I have been very intrigued coming back to the States with the announcements on the smooth jazz stations. And I won't be able to do it on this trip, but the next time I come back to America, I'm going to be recording as many of those stations as possible so that I can get all these announcers going smooth and then edit the S off and the so I have a whole bunch of people going moo, moo,
yes.
Moo,
yeah.
Moo.
What do you have in Australia to compare?
Well, so far, I don't think there is a smooth jazz station.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, yeah. They're all over the country.
Oh, sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, sometimes they actually play music that I like, but it's when you get all this ear candy happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's very bizarre. Radio, in fact, in Australia is very wonderful. There are three different levels. There's commercial radio, which is like here, and then there's listener sponsor supported stations, which is like college radio
like
here.
WBAI.
MBAI, and that's
like
stuff.
Calvos and Damien's home station, WGPR.
Yeah, and then there's the government radio, the ABC. And between the listener sponsor stations and the ABC, radio is actually a very serious art form. There are a number of interesting producers at the ABC who actually produce serious radio art. They're a member of the European Broadcast Union. And I can count on, as a freelance composer, I can count on, several, small commissions a year from the ABC for various things, like music for a radio play, or about every 2-3 years if I really push and I get lucky, I can get a commission for $2,000 to do a piece of radio art from a thing called The Listening Room. Or more recently, I was working with a wonderful New Zealand madman named Brent Clough on a show called Other Worlds and did a whole series of pieces for him, shows for him on The Voice and various ways of mangling it. And
The Voice!
The Voice!
The Voice!
Voice! And most recently wrote three little techno, that satire of techno music for him.
Okay, you have those?
Unfortunately, not with me.
Oh, no.
Darn. I could send them to you.
Yeah, send them along, and if you do, I mean, you can even send us an MP3 file of them, and we can broadcast them that way.
Oh, very good.
That's the easiest way to get them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to another one.
Okay.
Let's move on to this one that's in Sonic Circuit 6, La Strega Bianca.
I was having dinner one night with my friend Sergio Di Fieri, who's an organist and composer who lives alternately in Melbourne and Venice. He sort of commutes on a six-month basis. And Sergio was saying that no one had written him a piece for organ and tape in a while. And so I said, okay. And on the tram on the way home, I actually wrote a piece for him. It was a dark and stormy night. The wind was howling and howling. What else are you going to do on the tram? The organ and tape piece is quite nice. And I was doing an installation in Warrnambool, Victoria, which is an old whaling town. About 150 miles south of Melbourne. They have a beautiful little art gallery there. And so I was doing a series of sound installations there, and I used the same idea for that piece for one of the rooms. In the gallery, there were six rooms, so I had six different sound installations, filled the gallery with different kinds of sounds. In one room, as you walked in, there was this enveloping piece made of microtonal cords of sine waves that are beating against each other. It seems to be sort of an obsession of mine. It's very closely tuned sine waves that beat against each other.
Oh, I appreciate it enormously.
Yeah, it's not everything I do, but that's a recurring.
When we go off mic, I'll tell you about one of our pieces from
a recurring fetish of mine.
Yeah, yeah.
And so,
mind if we talk about the piece that you wrote for the downtown ensemble?
Sure, I got that right here.
Very successful piece. And so
it's very simply an abstract. Study in these chords and beats. It's also, speaking of academic, it's a 12-tone piece. I'm one of the last 12-tone composers I know. And this is a 12-tone piece, but the only problem with that for the 12-tone theory people is that the 12-tone row is simultaneously played in 12, 19, 31, 17 and I think 11 tone equal temperament, which is why you get all the beatings, because the 12 tone was played on the closest pitches to the 12 tones in each of those scales.
It's still all right. 12 tones.
But you know, Walter Zimmerman is writing in 12 tone, writing 12 tone music now too.
Mm-hmm. It's just another nice technique. It's
another 49.
And the title.
La Strega Bianca della Luna means the White Witch of the Moon, and the reason it was given that title was after Sergio and I had dinner. We noticed that there was a movie on TV, which is actually an Italian language movie, with English subtitles. And so we just sat down and watched it, and it was a children's movie from Italy called La Strega Bianca della Luna, The White Witch of the Moon. And so, you know, we stayed up till midnight watching this, and I got the last tram back to where I live. And so it was just named after this charming little Italian children's movie.
Italian children's movie inspired storm music on tram.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. Mm-hmm. Here it is. La Strega Bianca della Luna by Warren Bird. Thank you. We're back. That was that's funny.
I really like that piece.
Oh, thank you.
That is a great. We played it during our New York preview show, and it just was a lovely, lovely piece of work. Mm-hmm. You wanted to ask.
I wanted to talk about the piece you wrote for the Downtown Ensemble, because in a way that kind of incorporates what you were doing earlier with sort of more low tech mm-hmm. setup, and for such a sort of elegantly simple piece in terms of performance, I really liked it a lot, and everybody liked it a lot. It's always harder for a composer, unless you're Warren, to talk about your pieces.
I'll be happy to let you talk about it.
But I would just like to talk about a little bit, and that was that Warren set each, there were four players, and which were bass clarinet, flute, and electric keyboard that could play sine wave, is that correct? Mm-hmm. And he sent each of us a CD, and then a score. And so what we did was we would play a note that would sort of resemble what was on the CD, and the tone on the CD would be changing.
Very slow glissandis.
Yeah, and but we would try to maintain a constant pitch. And so when we heard the pitch change drastically, not just microtonally, we would then play the next note on the score. So it was very simple. I mean, it took no rehearsal. Which is perfect for...
The only rehearsal it required was to get all the CD players to work simultaneously, as I recall that.
Because some of the performers weren't exactly technically apt. You didn't realize that when you pressed pause, it didn't start at the beginning when you pressed it again. So it wasn't totally foolproof, but, I mean, just technically from a performer's viewpoint, I mean, it was a very easy piece in terms of being able to execute, and then it sounded really good. Is there anything you'd like to say about the piece? Which was Heat Wave, which during the second performance of it, I finally got the title.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
which was The Shimmering. You know,
Yes. You know, yeah, from the audience perspective, from being out there listening, I picked that up, and it was just absolutely lovely. But how did you conceive the piece? This is always an important...
Oh, and each performer had their own... I forgot to say this. This is important. Each of us had our own little playback system, so we each had our own little speaker that we played with.
Right, there was no master mixer
right,
doing
that's
this.
What I was
yeah.
Well, the low-tech comes out of the work that Australian composer Ron Nagorka and I began in 1974 in San Diego. When he was a student there as well. And we consciously began working in a burst of proletarian sympathy with very low technology to make it accessible. So rather than alienate someone with your big synthesizer, we would work with little mono cassette recorders.
Also, Warren, in a way, it's practical too, because it means that your piece actually has a chance to be performed.
Yeah.
Because if you put too many requirements in it, then the chances are it's going to be performed less and less.
Yeah, well, this also, in Australia, I did a lot of work with amateur groups over the years. And so I was very aware of, say, practicalities and getting things done and getting things done quickly. The previous year, I had actually written a piece with a vibraphone player where there was sine wave chords happening on the computer and him hitting chords on the vibraphone, and we were playing with this improvisational piece, we're playing with the beats. And so I thought, oh, I could take that idea and keep it practical so everybody has their own little sound system and work with that idea with four players.
So you're a beatnik.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh. Well, in fact, my pun is that I was born in 49, so I was too late to be part of it, but this is my way of being a member of the beat generation. And, in fact, I conceived of the piece when I was in California walking in the redwood forests around San Mateo, which is probably where Gary Snyder was walking as well, so I felt a real arboreal connection to the beat generation.
Here it is, Heat Wave.
Mm-hmm. written during a ferociously hot February in Melbourne and performed in a ferociously hot June in New York.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we almost passed out during the last performance in Kingston.
In Kingston, yes. By Warren Beat, or is it Warren Burt? Here it is.
Thank you.
And we're back. That was Heat Wave by Warren Burt, performed by the Downtown Ensemble. This is the first performance. This is the one at the Greenwich House in Manhattan. Oh, that was a great show, by the way. I attended two of the three, and they were quite wonderful. The one at the third one, where you almost passed out, was an astounding performance as well.
It was, but unfortunately, it was performed during a heat wave.
Yes, it was.
And it was so stifling in the performance space that, I mean, I almost passed out several times.
We had the fans on, and the birds came to visit during one of the pieces.
You should have done Tim Tennessee's Silent Fan. Because it was, the fans weren't silent, so we had to turn them off.
Where are you going with your work? Or is there more? Is there more that we can talk about now? I always like directions, though.
Oh, what are my directions?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about this sort of, I'm not sure if reduction is the right word, but the sort of simplification of some of the technological tools to make it accessible to more people to perform.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that a number of composers have started to do that. Do you think that's...
Well, I've been doing that for 25 years. I've really been trying to work on that. Simplification of means without necessarily simplifying either the sonic surface or the ideas behind it. But at the moment, where my own work is going is much more into a theatrical form of presentation, which is to say, in the past year, I've been doing a lot more improvising than I've done in the past, and the improvisations involve me talking and moving and making music, often with interactive technology, sometimes not. A typical piece would be a piece I did on the 20th of October, 1999, called Charles Ives' 125th Birthday, which was indeed Charles Ives' 125th birthday.
What a coincidence that a piece should have such an implication.
And what I did in that piece was I was playing my laptop, which is my main performing instrument these days. I was playing my laptop, and on the laptop was my reconstruction of the Life Pulse music from the Ives Universe Symphony, which, in fact, I realized later I read Ives' instructions wrong, so it's nothing like the Life Pulse, but it's my own version. And while that's happening, I also had a number of samples taken from Ives' work and was having little things happening with those as well. And I was also talking about my relationship with Charles Ives. I mean, how can you have a relationship with someone who died when you were five? But, you know, artistic relationship. And I was also reading the memos, reading bits of the Ives memos. And the conclusion of the piece, which about a 35-minute piece, performed it in a bookstore. They had a series of sound poets and readings, and so this was my contribution to it. And, in fact, a Collected Works bookstore in Melbourne, yours, one-stop shop for literary theory. There's a free ad on the internet for
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's not Jeffrey Barnard's store.
No, that's up in Sydney.
Do you want to give an ad for that, too?
He just runs that out of his bedroom. Yeah. No, this is a real shopfront on the main street of Melbourne. You go down this basement, and suddenly there's this amazing little bookstore that's bravely fighting off the Barnes and Nobles and the Borders and all those people.
They have those in Australia now?
Borders has started, yes.
Wait.
And I have to say that I do have sent people there because they were the only ones, except for Collected Works, that were stocking Harry Parch's books. And when Chris at Collected Works ran out, I said, go to Borders. Don't tell anyone. The conclusion of the piece was where I was reading the bit from the memos where Ives is talking about his 1933 Abbey Road recording studio session, which was the recording session from hell. And where everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Oh, do tell.
In fact, on the CRI recording of Ives Plays Ives, the first four cuts are from the Abbey Road session, and you can hear Ives making mistakes and swearing. It's quite wonderful.
So he did Abbey Road before the Beatles.
Oh, very. Yeah, he was well ahead of his time.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know if he walked across the street not wearing shoes, but... And while that's happening, then I just had all the things, the Life Pulse music, the samples all playing. The Life Pulse music playing out of little speakers, you know, little computer speakers, and the samples playing out of little tiny internal speakers on the computer. And I turned the sound up full, so it was really distorted. And interleaved with the Abbey Road recording session from Hell's story, I told the story of that morning, how I had tried to burn a CD-ROM of samples of Ives to use in the performance, and my CD burner, for the first and only time, had fouled up, and I didn't make the CD, And so I was reading about Ives doing a technological failure. I was moving around in, you know, this way on this bench in this bookstore doing this sort of dance that was a failure because I was seated on, you know, a high stool, much like this chair I'm sitting on. And I was letting the computer follow up, and I was telling a story about technological failure. So the whole thing came to this wonderful, you know, collapsing on itself sort of conclusion. And that's, you know, the sort of thing I'm getting more and more into is a more live, theatrical presentation of talk, music, movement, theatricality all merged together.
We sort spoke of a, sort of a Warren Burton version of failing.
Yeah, exactly.
Failing, right. Mm-hmm. We spoke to a composer this morning who predicts, who very strongly predicts the future of new music is theatrical.
Oh. I do recall a certain New York composer with a crew cut who back in 1960 said that we're heading in the direction of theater, which was John Cage.
Yeah.
It's well, with all my work that I've done with dancers, I mean, I do about a third of my work is collaborations with postmodern dancers.
Let's take that as a topic. It's okay. Finish your thought, and then tell us what it is like to work with dancers.
Okay. Because I do so much work with dancers, and I did so much work with interactive technology with dancers, it seemed the natural thing for me when I was demonstrating what I wanted them to do, what do you want to do with the technology? Here is what the movements will produce, that I would just get out there and move myself. And in 1989, did a project with another composer in Melbourne, Roz Band, and three dancers, Sylvia Staley, Jane Rafshoge, and Shona Innes, and an inventor, Simon Veach. And we worked on Simon's video movement detection system, which would detect movements and then turn them into MIDI signals for controlling synthesizers. And the way we worked on it was absolutely collectively for about 5 months, the three dancers, the two composers, and the technician. And in performance, the dancers insisted that we also move. And it was very interesting because the dancers, filled with postmodern dances, ideas of the body, were moving, say, from the pelvis, and mm-hmm. were moving from the breastbone, mm-hmm. and were moving from the spine. And Roz and I, being the composers, were moving from our ears. And we were actually, they'd say, you're actually leading with your ears. You know, your head is being pulled along by your ears. They could see that. And so we had very different movement types. Then in the early 90s, I began taking theater movement classes with Al Wunder, who's originally from Jamaica in Queens, but danced with Alvin Nikolai for a number of years before moving to Australia in the early 80s. And he's a wonderful teacher of improvisation, and I just began getting more and more into the whole theatrical movement sounding improvisation side of things, and it's really affected my work and affected my whole awareness of my body as a performative thing.
Mm-hmm. I just came up with this new theory, having ventured the opera recently, of there's a style of opera acting which is that they move through their hands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you move your hand and then you move your body towards the hand. Like
uh-huh.
Whenever that, you know, it's kind of like this, that all movement stems from their hand as if they're marionettes. And if
oh.
you look at it,
oh.
there's a whole group of people who are opera singers who act on stage that way. They do not move with their body. It's as if they move their hands and then they move their body towards their hands. It's hard to.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
And
I'll look
once,
for that.
Once you sort of catch on to it, you can't help but notice it, because there are some people who move very naturally and are just very aware of their bodies. But there are other opera singers who just don't have the faintest idea what to do. So they've kind of got this kind of stick with, you know, they'll move the hand and then they move their body to it and then they move back, you know, and then they'll move the hand up and then like this. And it's. You check it out sometime. Not everybody does it, but I would say about at least a third of opera singers move that way.
We'll have to start investigating many more operas than we're accustomed to.
Yes, we don't do the big opera thing on Calvos and Damien. As a matter of fact, our motto on the website has for 5 years says tunes and talk and not the opera.
Oh, very nice. Well, speaking of opera, my very next project when I get back to Melbourne is to actually work on an opera or a music theater piece of some sort.
Much better.
Working with a librettist who's also a computer graphics artist named Robert Randall. And it's two one-act operas, or two one-act theater pieces. First one, it's called Lost and Abducted has a subtitle of UF Opera. Lost is about a true story of a young man who got lost in the Australian bush. And this is a theme in Australian art for the past 150 years, is the terror of being lost in the bush. So Robert has written 12 poems, and I think it would be praising them too highly to call them doggerel. I say this about my very good friend of 25 years and my constant collaborator on Project for
the Past. Who has no internet connection, being passively here.
They're putrid. this is some of the most putrid poetry I've ever seen. And Robert has really worked hard to get them that bad. And so Robert will be reading them in a William McGonagall or Florence Foster Jenkins type voice while I am making environmental sound behind it, and he will have computer graphics of the very forest where the young man got lost. Now, hopefully we aren't going to get lost when we go to that forest, although Robert has about as much bushcraft as that Proteus synthesizer. I, on the other hand, know how to survive in the bush, so I think we'll be okay.
Also, it won't be like the Burt Witch Project.
No, it won't be the Burt Witch Project. The second one, called UF Opera, actually has a libretto, which Robert's working on as we speak, and a plot. And it concerns two people who are abducted by aliens, a male and a female, who are now in their respective psychiatrist's offices trying to recover the memories of what happened there. Or maybe it's about two unscrupulous psychologists who are manipulating their patients to have false repressed memory or false recovered memories. And we never let the audience know which. And what the nice thing about this one is that I'll be working with two, it's only for two voices, two singers who are also composers and improvisers. Hartley Noonan, who's a Renaissance countertenor, and for my mind, the best writer of neo-romantic art songs in Australia.
Art songs, yes.
And Carolyn Connors, who's an extended vocal technique singer and a comedy pop singer. And so I've got these two beautiful voices, this beautiful Renaissance countertenor who also sings bass, and then this very pure pop singer with like no vibrato who can also sing bass and who's an expert in extended vocal techniques. And both of them are very good improvisers. So I think the three of us with Robert's libretto are going to have a lot of fun. And then Robert will, of course, be able to do wonderful computer graphics with stretched faces about alien experiments, blah, blah, blah. And it should, they hopefully, well, we'll find out about the funding when I get back, but hopefully they premiere in July at the State Film Center in Melbourne.
Wow. Cool. Now, this is one reason that we need the Calvis and Damien television show. Next stop. Video.
Or at least a correspondent in Australia.
or at least one of those webcams that gives you one blurry out of focus picture every 30 seconds.
I like those. Yeah. You got one out there, you know, that we can jack into regularly.
Oh, yeah.
In Melbourne, there's a street webcam that's available all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, every year does a young composers competition. And it's in a different field every year. So one year it was computer music, one year it was orchestra music. Last year it was improvisation, and for the national finals, they actually broadcast worldwide with webcam and streaming audio.
Screaming audio?
Yeah,
screaming audio.
Well, in fact, the band that won were two young Hasidic guys from Sydney who do a very good screaming audio. And it was very high energy and loud and funky and a lot of fun. You got it, yes.
I'm hurting. We got to go out with something. What do we got? You got something?
I got something
you
here.
You hadn't held up for us to see yet.
Right. Okay.
Hold it up for our listening audience to see, too.
Okay, it says Microtonal Fake Chamber Music, 1993 to 97.
Very good.
And let's do an 8-minute piece called Tuning the Furniture of Chaos. And this is a live recording from St. Paul, Minnesota, done in the hall, which name I forget, but it was the first piece performed in that hall, anyway.
And the first piece performed in that hall, this is...
Oh, Metropolitan State University, their new concert hall. That's right. They just opened it in 94 when I was there.
We'll be hearing Tuning the Furniture of Chaos. For the moment, let's thank Warren Burt for joining us and Mary Jane Leach for co-hosting today's show. And Gina for providing the funding for Calvis and Damien to get to this set of venues. Yes, indeed. And here it is from Warren Burt, Tuning the Furniture of Chaos. Can you get it better?
Well, maybe not just yet, because we have to do a media swap here.
Yeah, and we think this is tuning the furniture of chaos.
Why, did somebody label the cassettes insufficiently?
I don't think so. I think they're exactly what they it purports to be, but 8 minutes, and now I...
Well, we'll play 8 minutes worth of what's on the CD.
That's right.
And hope that this is the piece we want.
Assuming that it will fit in the correct slot.
Media. Don't you just love it? There we go. It went into the little thing, and we're going to put the little play button on, and with any luck, Warren Burt's tuning the furniture of chaos.
Sounds like
hum.
It.
Like hum. Did you...
I'm Steve Smith, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
Here on WGDR Plainfield, I had a funny hum in the previous piece there. That was music by Warren Burt, tuning the furniture of chaos.
And that was the chaotic tuning that we heard.
It must have been it. That was just very odd. Odd hum in there.
I don't think it belonged, but I don't know where it came
from.
Nor
do I. Just visited. Well, here on the Bazaar, next week is going to be fun. We're going to broadcast the Festival of New Musics from Dartmouth College. That was recorded on May 2nd at Spalding Auditorium.
Partly by us, but partly not.
Yeah, well, we recorded it and then erased it
something.
So this is a remastered version from Mary Roberts. And we're going to be real happy about that because next week is the beginning of Calvos and Damien's sixth year.
You mean this one isn't?
No, this is the last show of the fifth year.
Oh, why is that? 261.
Correct.
Yeah?
It's the last show of the fifth year.
All right.
The first show of the sixth year.
Is not today,
no,
but next week.
Next week.
All right.
That's right.
The math is throwing me a little here.
Well, because we go by the nearest Saturday date.
Oh, I see. All
so
right.
So the nearest Saturday date is next week's May 27th.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah.
There.
See.
Fine.
Right. So, so we're going to celebrate with the performance, with the playing of that concert and some other things. We'll get together and cast our opinions about, sprinkle them like seed upon the land.
Might be time for a besto.
Maybe so. A little bit of everything next week. We'll Calvos and Damien will offer opinions.
As we're so reticent to do.
Yes, we never offer opinions about music that is good or weak or peculiar or exciting. We never say things like that. Speaking of which, here's a release from Artemy Artemyev. He sent us a number of compact discs in his Electroshock series. This is music by Artemy Artemyev himself. His dad, by the way, was a film composer, is a film composer in Hollywood.
Oh.
And Edward Artemyev, and did lots of scores which you may even know. Things like
77
Hercules. And, not exactly, but... But anyway, his son took to composing with a lot of equipment. Mm-hmm. He's an equipment composer.
Like a duck to a walk.
Yes, he uses Ensoniqs and Rolands and all sorts of things like that, Quadrasynths and Korgs and PCs and such, all mixed together in a great kind of stew of electronia to produce his music. And here's
paid for by Hollywood?
I suppose. It's, who knows? I always like to know those things, but I didn't ask. Maybe we'll get him on the show someday. Artemy Artemyev from his CD Cold on Electroshock. This is Freezing. Thank you. Nice dark music by Artemy Artemyev.
Yes, where's his sense of humor?
I'm sure it's somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
We have lots of stuff by him we'll be playing over time if we need to get real dark and deep.
Yes.
From his Electroshock series, very sort of an impresario of electronic music in Moscow. He has the Electroshock collections have electronic music from composers from all around the world. Some of them are really very, very interesting. So, let's have something more from tuning at ertha.mils.edu.
Oh, another low, depressing, dour piece?
Well, not necessarily. We could try this little thing. Maybe this is fun. By Bill Sitharis, Glass Lake for Drum Overtones.
Oh, yeah, I think we may have played that once.
Maybe. This is on the CD that also contains the Warren Burt Evening in Lancocks Park. So, let's sort of get the feel of these intonation systems. Here it is. From tuning at ertha.mils.edu, Bill Sitharis, Glass Lake.
Perked me up, I can tell you.
Sirree, Glass Lake. That's music for Drum Overtones by Bill Sitharis, who is a really interesting composer. We played his duet for Morphine and Cymbal a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really interesting, very transparent kind of sound he always works with, very light sounds. Let's hear something a little bit different.
You think you can change this pace, too?
Well, I can. I can make us happy again because it's probably like the, you know, maybe the baseball game's over by now and people are tuning into us again.
Of course.
And we have to sort of slide into the rock and roll or whatever it is that's going to follow us. So how about a little music by Dan Moses Schreier, who's also a film composer as well as a composer of electronic stuff. This is from Sonic Circuits 4. This is called Exotic, short version.
Oh, I'm all for
9 minutes
version.
Of short version, and if you get bored, you know, we can always change our mind.
We can do that.
Here it is, Dan Moses Schreier, Exotic.
Right. Those film composers, they find an ostinato or something, they can't go anywhere with it.
All right, well, shall we get rid of it?
Yes.
Because we have stuff from the Frog Peak Collaborations project we could play instead.
I think.
We could do them both at the same time.
I think it might work for a time.
Nothing better than using a long time, a few times, going to summer. And I felt bad, and the grandma all of them. I listened good. I said, I was from a stage, the principal's good. Is an emergent property of any system increasing probability of asking the right questions? Question. Pass off that or no? I was not sure.
There you have it, music by Warren Burt. That was Mangling number one, preceded by John Phillips. It was Adam Silverman's credit is The History of Words Without History, and starting out with Han Earl Park's Electronic Study for Limited Resources 3. And before that, what word did you describe that piece? Execrable.
Yeah,
I will just
I guess
help
so.
You along
yes,
there.
Yes, that's it. It's what happens when we preview music over the air.
Yeah, well, you know, Sonic Circuits is usually a pretty interesting series, and this sounded like it could have been a pretty interesting piece, and we like to entertain ourselves with those surprises.
Right, yes.
Wrong. Just keep that in mind when you see the name Dan Moses Schreier attached to a piece called Exotic. Don't play it. Okay, we'll remember that.
Yes. We encourage your comments as well.
Always. We love comments. Like ones like, well, who are you to judge?
That's right. Who are we?
The ones behind the microphone.
That's right. Stay
there. As, who is it saying that? It's our show.
Yes.
Yeah, well.
So we're about to judge a tune taken from the concert that we will feature next week on the program.
Yeah, this is DJ On. This is
who is John Appleton. This is a piece called Marco Polo Revisited, and I believe it's from either this year or the end of the last century.
Right.
He did this. And he did this live.
He's been taking scratch lessons in Japan to do DJ work.
Oh, not scratch lottery tickets.
Not that, maybe that too. And he came out with some folks with what were those yellow hazmat suits?
Hazardous, yeah, right.
Exactly. So he did this whole little DJ thing with his yellow hazmat suit. So join us for the full concert next week. All the pieces on this concert. It was a biggie. 11 major pieces, one of them divided into, I don't know, five sections. Festival of New Musics from Dartmouth College next week here on Calvis and Damien for the first show of our sixth year.
Centuries, they do pass.
Yes, here it is. Marco Polo Revisited by DJ On.
Thank you.
A production of Multimedia.